Hello and welcome to this podcast recording to review the February board meeting decisions on the insurance contracts project. I have with me today Daryl Scott, one of the board advisors for the insurance contracts project, and I'll be asking him a series of questions about the decisions the boards came to last week. Just as a reminder, all the statements made in this podcast are our personal views and they don't represent the views of the board in general. So Daryl, I think we made substantial progress in February, most particularly with the premium allocation approach for the short duration contracts. The boards have of course discussed this quite a few times in the past, and it feels like we're beginning to get somewhere with the decisions and in the place that we can move forward.
Yes, Andrea, I think we've agreed on this topic, perhaps with the FASB, that we'll agree to disagree. The ISB approach to the topic has been one of seeing the two models, the premium allocation approach and the building block approach, as being two parts of a single model. And as a consequence, a decision we've taken in this regard that premium allocation approach can be used when it closely approximates that of the business of the building block model follows that logic. What is positive, I guess, in the decisions that we took with the FASB is that we're using the same criteria to get to a decision process, and that means that even though we've got a slightly different view or approach to the problem, what we will find is that reporting should be quite similar between the two models proposed by the boards.
And you mentioned that we have the two criteria which are fairly similar between the two boards, and at the but I guess the main difference is the overlay of a principle in the ISB's decisions, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think it again reflects perhaps the one model versus two model view of the two boards. From an ISB perspective, we have started out by saying that the principle is that the premium allocation approach should approximate the result that would come from the building block approach, and that is our principle that we've established. We've then also gone a little bit further to say that because this is simply intended as a proxy for the alternative approach, it's permitted as opposed to required. We then have a bunch of criteria, and it's those criteria that are similar between the two different boards, and that'll probably result in the same outcome in most circumstances.
Yes, it was interesting to me from a staff perspective anyway that in each iteration we've done with the eligibility criteria for the premium allocation approach, for most of the contracts we looked at, you'd end up with the same answer however you did it, whether it was 12 months, whether it was the criteria in October, or whether in fact these criteria stay. So I think that's important. But one of the sort of knock-on differences, I guess, came in with the decision about permit versus require. I guess that's unexpected in a way and follows fairly naturally from the decision that it's one model and to use the principle. The exposure draft, of course, proposed that we required a premium allocation approach, and the ISB has now moved over to permitting the premium allocation approach.
And Ed, I think that's the correct decision. To the extent that the premium allocation approach is a proxy for building block, we shouldn't be forcing people to use it, and this should only be used where the circumstances warrant it and where it makes sense given the business model being applied by a particular entity. The principle that we've laid down that the one should reflect the other also suggests that those companies that want to use building block method for everything can use it without having any kind of repercussion on the integrity of their reporting process.
Thanks. And the last feature I really wanted to look at on the eligibility criteria was the 12-month practical expedient. Now, the exposure draft had, as its only requirement really, that we would use the premium allocation approach rather than the building block approach when the contracts were approximately 12 months. And that, in some way, has been carried forward by this practical expedient. What would you say were the main importance of this practical expedient?
I think the practical expedience, and they actually come up once or twice in the decisions we made at the set of board meetings, are really important. What they do is they absolve the preparer from having to go through a process to prove that something actually qualifies for a practical expedient, when it's the view of the boards that in the circumstances that we've given, for in this case 12 months, they are in all likelihood likely to qualify in any case. So it simply saves some effort on the part of the preparers.
And of course, when we give that sort of safe harbour for the 12-month left contracts, we are implicitly acknowledging that there might be cases within the 12-month contracts where it's not a good proxy, but we think that's okay. It's good enough, is what
Correct.
We're saying. Okay, we also talked a little bit about the mechanics for the premium allocation approach, and I guess these decisions, certainly to me, felt smaller than the eligibility, which has been the big outstanding decision on a premium allocation approach, but we talked about two things really. One was acquisition costs and the other was presentation. First, let's talk a little bit about acquisition costs. What would you make of the decisions there?
I think when we spoke about acquisition costs, what we were really trying to do was to align the premium allocation approach insofar as possible with the outcome of the building block approach. So the decision that we took around acquisition costs was to say that a company applying the premium allocation approach could capitalize acquisition costs in the same way as they would under the building block approach. But we also provided, similar to in the previous topic, a practical expedient here to say that if it was a contract that was less than 12 months, we leave it to the insurer to decide if they want to, in fact, write off those costs immediately. The idea behind aligning the two models very much supports the board's view that this is actually a single model and that the outcomes between the two models should be similar.
But I think we also had an idea that although we want the same approach for the acquisition costs, we're not yet 100% sold on our current approach, and there's a little bit of an appetite to explore other ways of presenting acquisition costs.
There is, and I think the presentation issue is something that's been coming up a couple of times in the board discussions up to now, and it really talks about how the deferred acquisition costs, the balance sheet asset, should be treated on the face of the balance sheet or the statement of financial position.
The other topic on the mechanics for the premium allocation approach was the discounting and interest accretion, and I guess there's no surprise really there that all the ISB and FASB members supported the decisions, which meant that we think there is an importance to time value of money in insurance contracts.
And again, this is a topic which I think has come up fairly frequently over the course of the insurance project, and both boards I think have been fairly consistent in emphasising the importance of time value of money in these contracts. What we have said again here is we've allowed for a practical expedient where the contract cash flows or where there's not a financial element to the contract. We've allowed also for that to be applied from a practical expedient perspective if the contract cash flows happen within less than 12 months of each other. In doing this, we've tried to align the wording to a certain extent with what the revenue contract, with what the revenue ED says, but we've realised that there may be a bit of an anomaly in the way revenue is worded. So we've fixed the wording in insurance, and what we would hope to do when we revisit revenue is to bring the wording in line there.
Good, thank you. Now, over the last 2 or 3 weeks, one of the topics that's been sort of stalking the corridors of 30 Cannon Street is hurricanes. And that really relates to the measurement of liabilities for infrequent high-severity events, which we've used as a shorthand. We've used hurricanes as a shorthand for everything that represents. Do you want to just talk us through a little bit the thinking and background to the decision that was made?
I think it's fair to say, coming from a non-hurricane country, that I've probably spoken more about hurricanes in the last 3 weeks than practically the rest of my life put together.
Me too.
The issue around hurricanes, and in fact any of these type of events, is the fact that information may become apparent to the preparer of the financial statements immediately after the end of their financial year. And the question really that we've tried to deal with here is how can that new information that's become apparent be dealt with in the course of the financials, of course of the preparation of the financials. In the end, after a fairly long debate and a debate leading up to this board meeting, I think what the boards have really come down to is that there is existing guidance. In the case of IFRS, that existing guidance is in IAS 10. They deal specifically with information that becomes available subsequent to the preparation of financial statements. And as much as we could see some benefits from being able to apply that information retrospectively, we believe that what was more important was to be consistent in the guidance that we have across our financials. So we've chosen here not to make an exception for insurance projects. We've chosen to stick with the existing IAS 10 guidance. But because there was some uncertainty around the board table about what that guidance exactly was, we've asked staff to clarify how this would operate in the insurance space through the use of an application example.
Good. All right, so, and I think it's fair to say that the other topics in the joint meeting were, in a way, more like housekeeping. The unbundling goods and services component, really just picking up on a criteria that we had discussed the last time we discussed unbundling goods and services, but didn't quite work for insurance contracts, which was the pattern of transfer services criteria. And the onerous contracts discussions really just picking up on one or two pieces of housekeeping from previous decisions that had been made. There was also an ISB-only education decision-making session on financial instruments with discretionary participation features, and this followed the day after the joint board meeting. Daryl, can you explain to us a little bit why you think it needed to come to a separate meeting and I'll fill you in with what the FASB intends afterwards.
This is a particularly difficult topic, I think, and we found it quite difficult in talking around the board table. In essence, discretionary participation features are dealt with and are a regular part of insurance contracts, and as a result, a process has been introduced into the insurance contracts ED and discussed and agreed within our deliberations as to how these should be treated. Failing dealing with them as part of the insurance contract process, investment DPF features, those are DPF features that are not found are found in contracts that are not insurance contracts, would be dealt with under our existing financial instrument guidance. But that guidance produces a very different answer potentially to what you find in the insurance contract standard. And so in discussing this at the outset, we needed to decide how we would deal with investment DPF contracts and where we would deal with them, either in the insurance standard or in the FI standard. FASB doesn't have the same problem because firstly, don't have many of these contracts in their jurisdiction, and secondly, they are fairly confident that their existing FI guidance does deal with it. Discussing it at the ISB, we were fairly concerned at the repercussions of this being put into the insurance standard where it would be out of sight potentially of people who weren't insurers. So we agreed that what we would do in the end is that we would include the same guidance for investment participation features as we have for insurance participation features, but limit that usage to entities that already imply, or to insurers. We've asked the staff to go away and figure out what the word insurers mean and how we would apply that in practice.
Yes, and I think it's important that to note that that's slightly different from the proposal in the exposure draft, because the existing IFRS 4 definition of investment contracts with DPF doesn't restrict it. In the exposure draft, of course, we restricted it to these contracts where the assets were managed in the same pool with insurance contracts, which is narrower than where the board wanted to take it this time. And as you say, we're going to go away and think about how best to achieve the limitation to insurers, and also to look at whether that causes any sort of operational difficulties. Just as an update on that, really, the FASB intends to discuss the applicable standard for these financial instruments with discretionary participation features at its meeting on the 7th of March. And the discussion paper the FASB issued last year proposed that these be excluded from the scope of the standard and insurance contracts, and the staff recommendation is to confirm that that proposal. Okay, so looking ahead to the next meeting now, the March meeting, we have at least three topics. One is a unit of account paper and definition of portfolio paper, which follows up from the initial discussions the boards had from December. In December, you decided that what we proposed was rather too over-engineered and sent us away to think about it some more, which we have done, and are bringing that paper back. We are picking up on the discussion on deposit components from the November meeting, really just picking up on the disaggregation approach that was discussed at the November meeting and taking that forward into how we would define the deposit components that would be subject to that and whether any other disclosures are required as well. We of course have a session planned on the use of other comprehensive income, and that's going to be an education session and is meant to dovetail with the discussion on the classification and measurement of financial instruments that the ISB and FASB will be having at that meeting as well. The March meeting, of course, follows really closely on from the February meeting by our normal standards, and so we may have one or two other topics, but we have not yet managed to decide whether or not they will actually make it in time for the posting deadline. So I think it's a case of watch this space. So thank you for listening to this podcast, and I hope you'll tune in again next month.